During the summer months, farmers' markets and most supermarkets overflow with fresh produce. But as we talked about on this show just yesterday, we may not always know what to do with all of that bounty. Many foods can keep for months if they're preserved properly, not only fruits and vegetables, but also meat and fish, and you may want to find ways to preserve them into the fall and winter. On today's Please Explain, the topic is preserving food, and joining us now is Daniel Gritzer, the former food editor at Food & Wine magazine, now the culinary director at the food blog Serious Eats. And we invite our listeners to join the conversation. You can do that by giving us a call at 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook and Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. Daniel, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
What are some great summer fruits and vegetables that are really good for preserving to stock up right now?
Well, right now, we're entering into peak tomato season, which is probably one of the fruits, technically a fruit slash vegetable, that I'm most excited about. But the truth is lots of fruits and vegetables can be preserved through a variety of methods.
The Italian tradition is to sun-dry them. Is that something you recommend?
If you have the space and the correct environmental conditions to do it, I would definitely recommend trying it.
How does that work?
It depends on what you are preserving. For example, peppers can be spread out on a mat or hung to dry. Usually you want a non-sunny spot, but warm and not too humid either. So in New York City, that can be a tricky thing to find.
Indoors or outdoors?
They'll do it outdoors. Again, if they have the right spot that's shaded, indoors is also possible. It's not uncommon to dry grapes in the attic, or oregano stalks turned upside down is another one.
There are lots of different kinds of tomatoes. Do some work better at preserving than others?
Yeah, this is an interesting question. I've actually just been doing some tests for work on how to store tomatoes in the short term. There are a wide variety of types of tomatoes and also quality of tomato that will impact your end results.
Well, you said store rather than preserve. Store means whether we put them in the refrigerator or not.
Right.
We're told not to put tomatoes in the refrigerator. Is that good advice?
It is not. What I'm finding is it's not entirely good advice. My tests are still preliminary, and I'm continuing to buy tomatoes quite happily.
Your test is on your family members.
That's exactly right, myself and my family members, and not in this case, but often on my colleagues as well. So what I've found is it's a bit more complicated. There's no question that refrigeration does harm to tomatoes. But there are many variables, including the ripeness of the tomato, the type of tomato which you had mentioned, whether they're meatier or they have more seeds and pulp and that kind of thing. All of those are going to change how the tomatoes fare depending on how you store them.
We used to be proud of our local beefsteak tomatoes, but everybody these days who can afford them prefers heirloom tomatoes. Are they any better?
We just did an article on the site about this very question, and the answer is not necessarily. Heirlooms are great because they're preserving varieties of tomatoes that were often on the brink of being lost, and they provide, you know, they're different colors, they're beautiful, you have different textures, different flavors, some are more tart, some are more sweet, but it really, what's more important is how the tomatoes are grown and when they're picked and harvested than whether it's a specific variety, an heirloom, for example, versus a hybrid.
The chef, Dan Barber, thinks that we should always be trying to perfect them rather than going back to older varieties like the heirlooms.
It's an interesting question. Certainly, we've gotten to the point we have in agriculture through millennia now of very careful breeding and selection of fruits and vegetables, so there's no reason to think that we should stop and freeze what we have in time.
Is freezing the way? If somebody wants to preserve, let's say tomatoes or any of the other things that are out there, let's think in terms of first the vegetable type things before we get to fruits. Are there certain better ways to preserve them?
Yeah, and this again is going to depend on the specific vegetable we're talking about. So firm vegetables, if we start there.
Well, cucumbers we pickle, right?
Cucumbers are great pickled. Cucumbers tend not to freeze very well. They're so watery. And the water content does have an impact on how well a vegetable is going to freeze. So, for example, corn or peas, string beans, carrots, these types of vegetables, some are technically botanically fruits, but they'll freeze very well if you take the right steps. Tender ones, tomatoes, watery ones, cucumbers, they will tend not to freeze very well in the raw state. It doesn't mean you can't do it.
What will you freeze them in? Will you put them in freezer bags and try to squeeze as much air out, or do you prefer to put them in containers?
So even if we take a few steps back, it even starts with the purchasing of your fruits and vegetables. Corn and peas are a great example. These are vegetables that or fruits that very rapidly, once they've been picked on the farm, start to convert their sugars into complex starches. And in a matter of hours, you can see a real loss in quality and how sweet they are. So the first step, and this is terrible for me because I'm not an early riser, is really to try to get to the market as early in the morning as you can, especially for things like corn and peas, because you will see a difference, especially if the farmer's picking that produce right before coming to market, which is hopefully the case. You want to grab it when it's still the less time between plant to being taken to the farm and all of that, the better. So that's the first step. Then once you've purchased your produce, hopefully you've chosen some good stuff, it's still sweet, then the size is the next thing. Small things, when you freeze them, freeze better than large things. So corn and peas, again, freeze very well. If you have something like a carrot...
But when you say corn freezes well, you're talking about shucking the corn.
Right, I'm talking
about... You're not putting the whole piece of ear of corn into the freezer.
Exactly. I'm talking about cutting the kernels off the cob. In the case of peas, also...
Yeah, that's what I meant.
So
shucking is when you take the other stuff off.
Right, taking off the husk and the silks and that kind of thing. So there's always some level of preparation. If you have larger vegetables like carrots, you're going to want to cut them down to smaller sizes. And the reason is because there's actually a step in between that and freezing, which is blanching. But once you do get into the freezer, the smaller the food pieces are, the better they're going to freeze, because the faster something freezes, the better it's going to freeze. When the water in these items starts to freeze, it forms ice crystals. And the more slowly that happens, the larger the ice crystals are going to be. And those are going to damage the cell structure more if they're large.
And damaging cell structure is a concern with freezing in general, isn't it?
It is.
People sometimes say that you shouldn't freeze meats because it damages the cell structure. And yet, so much meat comes to us frozen. If you go to a farmer's market, there's a good chance that the very expensive meat that you're purchasing, that wonderful organic mm-hmm. meat, is given to you frozen.
That's exactly right. And much of the fish that we get is frozen in advance as well, including out at sea on the boats because mm-hmm. they're out for so long. I think there's no question that freezing to some degree or another in most cases will degrade the quality of whatever food you're talking about. But there are steps that can be taken to minimize the loss in quality and capture as much of the good quality as possible.
Well, it seems to me that there's no loss with peas. There's no loss with blueberries for some reason, maybe because they're so dense. In that case, you should probably lay them out on a tray when you freeze them because you don't want them to freeze together and become clumped.
Right. You want to tray freezing is pretty much what you want to do with everything. And it's for the reason you just said, which is that you don't want them to freeze in a clump. They'll freeze if they freeze individually, they'll stay frozen individually. Also, if you freeze them in a clump, it's going to take more time for the cold of the freezer to penetrate into the center of that mass, and that's going to slow down the freezing process, and that's going to create the larger ice crystals. So again, along the same lines of thinking of why you want small pieces of vegetables and fruits that you're freezing, you also want to spread them out as much as possible because you really want that cold to get in there as quickly as possible.
We're talking about preserving summer's bounty with Daniel Gritzer, who's culinary director at Sirius Eats. We're talking about this on today's Please Explain segment. And we are inviting your calls at 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook and Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. I am Leonard Lopate, and this is WNYC, WNYC.org. So we have determined that if you're going to freeze something, you should do it with something that doesn't have a lot of water in it. Things that do have a lot of water in, we're more likely to pickle or make into jams and jellies and other kinds of preserves?
Yeah, tender, delicate, water-laden fruits and vegetables are, one can freeze them. You can buy a bag of frozen peaches, for example, but I wouldn't recommend trying to eat that in a fruit salad or out of hand.
Put it in a smoothie.
You could put it in a smoothie, yeah. So there are ways to still use those fruits and vegetables once they're frozen, but you've reduced your number of options.
Well, what about pickling? How do you ensure that, well, first of all, you have to come up with a brine.
Right.
What does the brine consist of? Is it mostly salt or do you use vinegar?
Quick pickling, it depends what kind of pickling you're doing. So if you, the easiest entry point into this is what's called a quick pickle. And that's a brine that you make with vinegar. It's usually diluted with a little bit of water and has salt in it and often some sugar to balance that acidic strength of the vinegar. And that's a very easy way to preserve vegetables like cucumbers. The vinegar will basically you're getting this strong acid right away onto them, and so the effect is immediate. You can pickle also with just salt, and that's basically fermentation pickling, which I love to do at home. It takes a little bit more research to make sure you get it right and don't have it go wrong. But basically, you create a high salt environment where harmful microorganisms can't really thrive, but beneficial ones, specifically lactobacillus, can get to work eating the sugars in what you're pickling, and it will then produce lactic acid. So in essence, you end up with that tart flavor.
Although there are many different kinds of pickles. There are sweet pickles, there are tart, sour, half sour. It all depends on what you brine the cucumber or whatever else. What are some of the other things that you might want to pickle?
Okra. You can pickle okra. Is great.
I've had pickled tomatoes.
Pickled green tomatoes do very well. Carrots pickle really well. String beans pickle very well. It's kind of endless.
And then you just put different kinds of things. You could put flavored vinegars in. You can put different herbs in. What's the typical shelf life for a pickled vegetable?
It depends. If you don't do any processing of them, meaning putting them in going through a canning procedure, which can buy you many, many, many months, up to a year, you maybe have a week, 2 weeks for your quick pickle. It really depends. Conservatively, let's say a week. I think probably a lot of people I certainly know my mom has eaten strange pickled things out of her fridge much longer than after it's been made than anybody would recommend.
What about canning fruits and vegetables? Do you need to use a mason jar?
Mason jars are great for canning.
And you boil them, I assume.
Right. You either boil them in a pot of boiling water or in a pressure canner, which is basically a large pressure cooker. It depends what you're canning, whether you'd want to be in one type of pot or another.
I'm assuming that if you don't do it right and it isn't completely sterilized, you can cause trouble for yourself.
Yes. The big risk with canned foods is botulism. Unlike most microorganisms, harmful ones, botulism thrives in an environment that's low in oxygen, which is exactly what you're doing when you can something. So there are steps that you have to take, and there are guidelines that should be followed that have to do with the acidity of the food that you're canning and the amount of time that you keep it in its hot water bath or in the pressure canner and things like that that will protect against this sort of worst-case scenario.
Let's take a couple of calls. We go now to Barry from Hell's Kitchen. Hi.
Hello. Good afternoon.
You're calling from a kitchen, so that's a good sign.
That's a good sign.
Even if it is Hell's.
I think I've got freezing down to an art. Often my work hours such that I'm not coming home till after midnight. And during the day, if I have some time free, I go to some of my purveyors in Hell's Kitchen, and often, you know, they've got a little stand where it says tomatoes on sale, and there's tons of tomatoes, and they're bruised and a little damaged, and I'll buy bags of them for less than $5, come home, and it takes me a while, put on some music, chop them up, put them in a pan, add basil and soy sauce, etc., make it into, you know, all mushy, and then put it into containers and freeze it. And that's my, you know, fresh pasta sauce. When I come home late at night and I drop in some pasta, just pull it out of the freezer, and there's my pasta sauce. And it's less than $5, and I've got tons of it in the freezer.
And just so I understand, are you cooking these tomatoes when you throw them in the pot?
Yeah, fry it with onions, basil, et cetera, et cetera. Just mush it down, add some soy sauce if I've got some wine left over, and there's my pasta sauce.
That's great. That's actually something we recommend on our website. My colleague Jay Kenji Lopez Alt has a really informative article on preserving spring and summer produce, and for those tender, delicate fruits and vegetables like tomatoes, like eggplant, the tip is to cook first and then store second, because they'll fare much better that way.
Do you have a favorite pasta sauce?
Oh, boy. That is hard. Off the top of my head, maybe amatriciana. I'm passionate about that stuff.
You could also use to make a jam out of tomatoes, can't you?
You can. You can cook tomatoes down with, you can have onions in it with the natural sweetness of the onions that can contribute to that jam-like quality, or you can even add some sugar. And treat tomatoes very much like you would a fruit when making a jam.
When we come back, let's talk about making jams. My guest is Daniel Gritzer, who is culinary director at Serious Eats. We're talking about preserving summer's bounty on today's Please Explain. And our number here is 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. We're back with Daniel Gritzer, the former food editor at Food & Wine magazine, now the culinary director at the food blog Serious Eats. We are talking about preserving summer produce and other parts of the summer's bounty on today's Please Explain, and taking your calls at 212-433-9692. Also, you can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. Let's take a call from Robert from Manhattan, from Morristown. Hi.
Yeah, hi. So my mother always used to cut up fresh herbs and then freeze them in ice cube trays, just sort of as a way of preserving them. But I always wondered if there was a better way of going about storing herbs, I guess, like aside from drying them.
That's a great question. The ice cube tray is a good trick, and I've seen it done with herbs that are chopped up and then frozen in water, and I've also seen it done with herbs that are set in olive oil, which is an interesting thing.
Which herbs work best for that?
I've seen it with parsley, with basil. I mean, a lot of people will make a pesto and then freeze that in ice cubes and take it out of the fridge as needed.
I just freeze the pesto, and then when I defrost it, I put the cheese in.
Right. Exactly.
But don't freeze it with the cheese. At least I've been told.
Well, yeah,
not to
cheese does not freeze well. So you do want to keep the cheese out of the preparation until you put it in the freezer. And you can also, if you want more versatility with what you can do with it, you can also just do the basil in the oil and then decide later whether that's going to become a classic pesto or whether you might use it in some other direction. I've seen a trick that online where somebody takes parsley and wads it up really tightly into a log in a Ziploc bag and then rolls that up and then slices off this sort of parsley log as needed later in the year. I suppose it could work for cooking, but that's most herb freezing methods aren't going to give you herbs when they come out of the freezer that you would want to use fresh. You'd probably want to cook with them.
Robert, how do you use those herbs?
I typically put them in the water, and then when I'm ready to use it, I'll melt them and then try to strain off some of the water, you know, just to get it back to mostly herb. But that's basically what I do.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for calling. Can you freeze herbs whole, like lemongrass?
You know, I think my mom has done lemongrass in the freezer, so I haven't tried it myself, but I'm going to venture and say that that might actually work. It's pretty robust, very fibrous vegetable, so or herb, so lemongrass might work. Otherwise, they're so delicate, most herbs, that the cold of the freezer is really going to do damage. And in that sort of balance you're trying to strike between the loss in quality and preserving over time, herbs they're definitely a trickier one.
The author of a book on herbs, Michael Balick, who was on our show a couple of weeks ago to talk about herbs, suggests freezing the leaves of leafy herbs like thyme, mint, basil, oregano in those ice cube trays, mm-hmm. with a little bit of water. Mm-hmm. I guess the water doesn't affect the final taste in the way that olive oil would.
Right. If you freeze it in olive oil, you have olive oil coated herbs when you're done.
Well, what about the drying the herbs? We usually buy them at the supermarket, and then a year later realize that we've used up about 1/8 of the whole very expensive little shaker. So, and then we have to throw it away. But can we just as easily dry our own?
You can dry your own herbs, and dried herbs are something that fell out of favor, I think, as you know, for a while it was just a convenience product, and most herbs, I think, in the country were being consumed dry, and chefs and other cooks said, hey, you know, the fresh herbs are actually entirely different, and we should be valuing that. And
there's a place for both, isn't there?
Exactly. I think the pendulum is, you know, it sort of swung the other way, but there's a midpoint on that. And for certain preparations, dried herbs are fantastic. Oregano, of course, dries wonderfully. So does rosemary. I've been in Italy in the early fall when rosemary is still growing on plants, and I've been served certain dishes where the rosemary is dried. It's a conscious choice to use the dried in certain instances.
Bill from Mineola, hi, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. In regards to fresh cherries that you get from the supermarket, when you freeze them, I know the instructions on the bag specifies to take the stems off, remove the pits, mm-hmm. Wash. Can you reverse that process and actually freeze them as is and then clean them up later?
It helps to do those preparatory steps first, in part because, again, you want to reduce the size of the thing you're freezing. So if you pit the cherry, what you're left with is basically there's more surface area of the cherry that's exposed. Either it's in half or there's a hole going through the middle. That's going to help the cold penetrate through that cherry faster. It's generally you want to wash most things very well before you freeze them, and then dry them very well because surface water will be damaging in the freezer if it's left on. But it is helpful to take those steps up front instead of freezing fruits whole.
Now, why ask, Bill? In the end, you still have to pit the cherries and take the stems off. So what's the difference between doing it before or after?
Right. I guess it's just being lazy, being able to just throw them right in the freezer and forget about it.
Thanks for calling. Another question about cherries, I gather, from John from Paramus. Hi, John.
How you doing? Yeah, two questions about cherries in a row. I like those things.
We lost him. But basically, I gather he wanted to ask about preserving cherries in brandy. There are a number of things that you can preserve in alcoholic beverages.
Preserving fruit in high-proof, relatively high-proof alcohol is a great thing to do because you end up with both the fruit that you can eat spooned on ice cream or on a cake, and you also have this infused brandy at the same time.
So the brandy takes on some of the cherry flavor, and the cherry takes on, well, whatever the fruit is. It could be peaches. It could be...
It can be other berries. You really can use a variety of fruit for something like
apples.
Apples, and I don't know if I've ever... My concern would be that they would take on a not pleasant texture sitting in liquid like that.
Let's talk about making jams and jellies.
Mm-hmm.
How difficult is it?
It's not particularly difficult. On its simplest level, a jam is it's quite a rustic thing. You're cooking fruit down with sugar and maybe a little bit of acid, like lemon juice, and then you have jam. There are finer points to the process.
Well, there are quick jams that you put in the refrigerator and you can keep for about a week, and then there are other ones that you can put up for, I guess, forever.
Right, and part of that has to do with whether you put your jams through the canning process or not. Basically, the sterilization and sealing under vacuum process of canning, or whether you don't. If you don't, the shelf life of the jam is going to be shorter.
And jellies are different because they have gelatin in them?
Jellies, to me, it's a textural difference that's being described. So a jelly is almost like a fruit juice that's set either with gelatin or pectin, whereas a jam still has the whole fruit cooked down into it.
You've worked in farms in Italy and Spain. Did you find that any tips or tricks, did you learn any tricks on the way that people store food in Southern Europe?
We're very concerned, I think, understandably and rightfully, with food safety and best practices for minimizing things like botulism risk and all of that. But I've seen firsthand that people frequently, at least the farms I was on in Europe, do not follow many of these practices. Refrigerators can sit empty, and food is often stored in places that we would never probably think of storing them, and nobody gets sick, which doesn't mean I'm recommending this for anyone, because I could probably get in trouble.
But why do you think that is?
I imagine, and this is, I'm speculating, but I imagine that the risks that we're concerned with in terms of actual probability of happening might maybe lower than we fear they are. Now, when you have an industrial food system, one little thing gone wrong can end right. up in a million jars of product.
Well, one person dying from botulism can lead to a serious concern and even a panic.
Right. So I absolutely wouldn't want to discount that. But I've seen many people break these rules, and more often than not, they're fine. But you don't want it to go wrong. There's no question about that.
You've also made charcuterie in France. That may be one of the oldest methods of preservation.
That's true.
How do you make charcuterie?
It depends on what you're making. Hams and things like that can be salted and then cured by hanging in a similar, actually, to drying peppers and things like that in a cool, breezy environment. I've made blood sausage. I did that on this one farm in the southwest of France that. I was just thinking about that the other day. I almost want to try to make it again.
Of course, you could also do that with fish. Gravlax is a form of preserving, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah.
And in that case, it's salt and then spices that preserve the fish?
Right. Gravlax is fish, usually salmon, that is packed in salt. There's also usually sugar and spices like pepper, herbs, often dill. You sometimes aquavit and that kind of thing gets into the mix, and the salt draws out moisture from the fish, and that removal of moisture is part of what helps increase the shelf life of the fish that you're preserving. That's not a long-term storage method for salmon, but it's a short-term storage method.
Dairy products do not freeze well, do they? I guess you can freeze butter, but would that be it?
Dairy products do not tend to freeze well. Cheeses, both young cheeses that are softer and creamier, and also aged cheeses, don't behave well in the freezer. And sour creams, yogurts. I think part of the issue is that a lot of these things are. It's different in each instance. But take yogurt for example. That's essentially a coagulated, almost a gel that's formed through the lactic acid bacteria. And the ice crystals are going to cut through that very delicate matrix, and then you're going to end up with some textural problems once it defrosts.
You can freeze bread.
Freezing bread is the better way to store bread. Refrigerating bread actually speeds up the staling process.
Can we use a microwave to do any of the drying of herbs?
Yes, you can dry herbs in the microwave. You can dry herbs in a low oven. You can dry herbs out if you have the right again, environment where it's not too humid and it's warm. But the microwave for small batches of herbs is a pretty neat trick, because it happens so quickly that it preserves more of their green fresh qualities than you would at a low heat, longer drying method.
Alex, hi, you're on the air.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, I have a question about kale. I eat kale all year round, and I really like it, but I find that there's so much right now in the farmer's market, but I have no idea how to freeze it. I tried it once, and it kind of crystallized and got soggy and gross. Mm. I know you can't do it with lettuce, but kale seems to be such a heartier green that I was wondering if you have any tips or tricks for making my kale last through the winter.
Definitely. One thing with kale, and this is a part of the freezing process that we haven't touched upon much yet, is the importance of blanching before you freeze most vegetables. So what you want to do with kale is, first you want to remove the woody stems, and you want to blanch it in boiling water, and then it's just for a minute, maybe 2 minutes. Your goal isn't to really cook the kale. Your goal is to technically, you're trying to shut down certain enzymes that are going to be responsible for those bad effects that you were seeing when you froze the raw kale.
Should you put salt in?
Generally, with blanching, salt is recommended. And salt is fine. I did some tests. The gospel of blanching is big pot, salted boiling water, and then shock and ice. And I did every cook can sort of recite that. It's just how everyone does it. I did some tests not too long ago for work, and found that actually a smaller pot tends to work better. It's also just quicker and more efficient. The logic of the big pot is that when you put your vegetables in that you're blanching, it's going to return to the boil faster. But the truth is that the amount of energy that you have to put into the pot to return it to the boil doesn't matter whether it's large or small.
And the same applies to pasta, by the way. In the past, you were told to use a lot of water. Now I gather that isn't really necessary.
That's exactly right.
This is probably the same reason, the same chemistry.
It's the same principle, the thermodynamics.
But what about that ice bath?
Oh, so the ice, right. So then you want, with the blanching, because you now have all of this heat in your kale, you want to stop the cooking as quickly as possible, because you don't want to end up with overcooked kale that you then freeze. So as soon as it's had that minute just to get, I guess, crisp tender, we might say, you want to shift it into this ice water bath, get it as cold as can be as quickly as possible. In my tests, I found that really does make a difference. And then you want to squeeze out as much excess moisture as possible before you move to the spreading it out on a tray. And again, you want to do that same thing, spreading it out on a tray to get it to freeze as quickly as possible before transferring it to a bag with as much air removed.
So, Alex, you're going to have a lot of kale this winter. Thank you so much for calling us, and thank you, Daniel, for being on our show today. We've been speaking with Daniel Gritzer, who is a former food editor at Food & Wine magazine, now the culinary director of the food blog Serious Eats, and we've been talking about preserving summer's bounty on today's Please Explain. It's been a lot of fun. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
And bon appetit.